Today is Sunday, March 21, 2021. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Doing great, Tom. Good to hear from you.
Well, thank you so much for letting us continue with this oral history with you. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Sure, no problem.
Thank you. When we concluded part 7, the next thing you were going to do was to climb Confluence Butte in, I think, 1986. Can you pick that thread up?
Sure, I'm happy to. And before we jump into that, though, I wanted to make a correction about the discussion that we had in our last session.
Sure.
About my trip to Molly's Nipple, because I think I gave you the year 1981, but I went back and checked my notes, and it was actually 1980,
okay.
March 1980. So, and you know, I forgot to tell you too. Can we just kind of go freeform here?
Yeah, you bet.
I don't know if we talked on that trip about the end of it, but you know, I went and I climbed Molly's at the beginning and then spent some time down in the Red Wall and then and came up back to the Esplanade and met some uranium miners up there. And we had a good talk about geology and whatnot. And then as I was getting back to my car there, there was a snowstorm setting in. Did we talk about that? I don't know. Well, I'll just throw this in anyways. But I had, at the time, I had a Karmann Ghia, right?
Right.
I had
a
soft
top
Karmann. Yeah, and... I got to the up at the top of Andrus Canyon there, and the snow had already settled in a few inches, and it was late in the day. I mean, it was night, right? And
okay. And
so I just decided to sleep in my Karmann Ghia, which was quite a little trick because I remember I had to put the seat down flat. And anyways, I got all my gear in there and actually got my sleeping bag out, slept in the Karmann Ghia, and when I woke up in the morning, there was like a 10 inches of snow on the ground.
Wow.
Fortunately, I had chains in the back.
Okay.
And, in the front, because in the Karmann Ghia,
the
only storage space in the back is your engine.
That turns your little car into a snow plow.
Yeah. And so I had these chains, and unfortunately, they were a little too big. I remember very distinctly. But I put them on, and I was able to get back up because I had driven down into a small vale or valley, right, and where I parked my car before I did the hike, and I was able to get back up onto the platform there, and then drove the roads back out towards St. George with these chains, oversized chains, clanking in the back of my rear wheel for like 40 miles before I was able to take them off. It was just mind-rattlingly loud, you know, because it's a Volkswagen and it was a ragtop, and there's not much sound protection in there. But anyways, that was a very eventful ending to that.
How much damage did the chains do to the car?
You know, there wasn't any damage. It was because it was up inside the wheel well. I mean, it may have beat up the inside of the wheel well, but I didn't see that.
Okay.
And besides, by that time, that car had a lot of. It had a lot of scars on it, you know, a lot of dents, and because I took it everywhere, you know, going into these remote areas. And in fact, my friend Jake Daly, he's not really a friend yet, but we're developing a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
He lives in Arizona. He's doing a lot of climbing, and we've been corresponding. And he's going out to Molly's next week.
Cool.
And he said he tried to go in there last winter, and couldn't get his car in very far. It sounded like he was quite a bit short of where I got my car in. So, anyways, I mean, the roads have no doubt changed quite dramatically since then. But, you know, that car went everywhere. And if there was some sort of evidence of my Molly's trip, I probably wore it proudly as a scar of the experience, right? So, I wanted to correct that. And then, you know, there are a couple of other miscellaneous things that happened in this time. I mean, at this point, you know, I had moved to California to go to graduate school in Davis. And that was taking up a lot of my time. But I still made, you know, opportunity to come to the, back to Arizona, visit my family, and then also to do some hikes in the canyon. And we talked about the trip to Sassy-Nasquet Butte that
right.
I went on with Bruce and Bill Murphy. And unfortunately, we couldn't get up it because we ran out of time. Then it was another trip I took into Royal Arch Creek, and which was really interesting for me with my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, it was pretty – well, it was just a very interesting trip because it was one of the first – one of the earlier trips when I was corresponding with Harvey, and so we were exchanging back and forth with Harvey Butcher.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were exchanging in back and forth with information. And I remember very distinctly he wrote me this very extensive, very courteous letter, telling me the intricacies of the route into Royal Arch Creek, which is not that complex once you're on it.
Right.
And then he very graciously said, "I'm sure you will have no problem doing this after you did the mile 49.3 Redwall route, right, in Marble Canyon." And anyways, it was just a nice little hike there. That would have been in 82. Another trip I took in 82 in Christmas time was with my friend Chris Beale. We talked about him earlier in the recordings, and I think this might have been the last time that Chris and I hiked in the canyon. Would have been in December of 82, and we decided to go into Phantom. My plan was to try and climb Isis, right?
Okay.
And so the idea was we'd go into Phantom and then go up the Redwall at the end of Phantom, and then do Isis from there. And I had done that Redwall route when I was on that long hike in the early 70s. And so I went in with Chris, and unfortunately he developed knee problems.
Ooh.
And we couldn't get there. Although I was able to reascend the Redwall route, and did it in a much cleaner style than my first time through there. I did that by myself solo. So, you know, there was I've tried to do Vishnu three times.
Okay.
And the first time was in the 70s, and I was up there with three other friends, Doug Rickard, and we may have touched on this, and my friend Kent McClellan and Scott Kronberg. And Scott Kronberg, I did, you remember, I did Horace with, one of the first big climbs I did in the canyon.
Right.
And Kent McClellan was a friend of mine from high school, and we did some climbing in central Arizona. And Kent at this time was just coming off a broken wrist, right?
Ooh.
So he was actually in a cast, had his arm in a cast. And we decided, the four of us, this would have been in the mid-70s, that we were going to try Vishnu. And from the North Rim, there's a fairly complicated route down through the Kaibab right near Point Imperial.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, right near Cape Royal.
Yes.
And we got down through the upper part of the Kaibab and down into the top of the Coconino, and Kent slipped.
Ooh.
And re-broke his wrist.
Ooh.
Right? So, yeah, so we had to abandon that. The four of us abandoned that attempt and went back up to the rim. And we found a nurse on the North Rim, and she looked it over and said, "Well, you're going to have to get this checked out." But it wasn't a situation that he, you know, it wasn't a compound fracture or anything like that. So we actually went out and climbed the dragon and the dragon's head after that, before we went back to Arizona. So that, back to Phoenix. So that was the first time I tried to do Vishnu. And the second time, again, was with Chris. And so, I'm sorry, it was with Bruce Grubbs. And in 86, and Bruce and I, it was probably Bruce's idea because he was big on skiing, but we decided that we would drive into House Rock Valley and then hike as far as we could up South Canyon on the trail there, and then put on the skis when we had to and go up to the rim and then come in on the east side road that comes down right along the edge of the park there and then passes west of Point Imperial, and then you can join up on the Walhalla Plateau Highway, right? So we skied in that way, and the plan was then to ski down to Cape Royal and then just jump down and go climb Vishnu. But as things would have it, we got to the rim, and there was snow down to good snow down to about immediately west of Point Imperial, and then it started getting a little spotty, right? Hmm. And so we wound up having to basically walk with our skis on all the way down to Cape Royal there, and I had talked Bruce into trying to go down the ravine route that's about a mile north of Cape Royal.
Uh-huh.
And I had been down there on my own once before and just scouting it out. And there's a series of ravines. One of them has a car in it from the 40s, I guess, or 30s that went off the highway. But I didn't find the right ravine when I went in there the first time. So I actually talked Bruce into trying that as our approach route to Vishnu. Because then you can, once you get down below the Coconino, you can contour along the Supai below Cape Royal and then get back on to the standard route out to Vishnu there. Although I guess you river runners come up from below. So anyways, Bruce and I again tried that, and we got down through the Coconino, and we're looking at the long traverse to the Supai, plus considering the return that we would have to do to his car, which was parked in House Rock Valley. And we said, you know what, it's just not going to happen this time because it's still from that point, it's still 2 days minimum to climb Vishnu. So we unfortunately had to drop that one and then just retrace our steps. But, you know, I remember sitting there in the Ponderosa Forest duff, you know, the needle, the duff of needles that accumulates beneath the ponderosa pines,
right
on the lip of the canyon. And of course, you know, we'd skied in, we hadn't seen anybody. It was totally isolated. And I'm sitting there and after we decided to bail on this climb, we kind of had extra time to kill, right? We could relax. And I just remember sitting there in the sunshine, up against my pack, underneath the ponderosa, with the needles all around, the gentle breeze blowing, and then just shooting the bull with my friend Bruce, you know, for a couple of hours before we returned back to the grind of getting back to the car. And just such a wonderful experience. And that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of memories that I keep, right, and have retained.
Nice.
So much of my canyon hiking experience are those kinds of recollections and just kind of prime emotional responses, you know, to being out there with your friends.
Yeah.
Usually when you're there with your friends, it's positive, and sometimes when you're there solo, it can be negative, as we've talked about, and scary, but anyways, just an interesting experience, and that's what has stuck in my mind all these years, right? It's not the disappointment of missing out on Vishnu the second time, but the time I had with Bruce just sitting there and soaking up that canyon experience. So now we're getting back to Confluence Butte because after the ski trip, which was in April. I have here in my notes, I'm keeping my notes open this time, so I try and minimize mistakes.
Okay.
But that was on April 7th to 11th. And then we said, well, what are we going to do as a consolation prize, right? And I said, well, I know there's this butte out over the junction of the confluence of the little Colorado and the Big. And I said, I don't know, you know, Major Powell's brother did a climb in there, and I think it was his brother, when on the Powell expedition, and you would know that better than I, but I said, why don't we go try for that? You know, we don't know what it's like out there, and mm-hmm. it looks impressive because you could see this from Char, right? It's directly across from
right.
Char. And so, you know, whenever I was out doing climbs and hikes and whatnot, you know, you're always scouting out other opportunities. And this was not a named summit by any means, but it certainly looked elegant, right?
Mm.
Looked neat. And it was in a nice setting because it's just sitting up there overlooking the junction of the two rivers, right?
Yeah.
So we decided to do that, and we drove around then and worked our way out on the roads across the plateau. And you know, we would have had the old maps, which are not very precise, but at least they're pretty. I think they showed the plateau, the Navajo reservation roads pretty well, and so we were able to find our way out to this point that we'd have to drop down to get, you know, to Confluence Butte. And it was really windy that day, I remember, and we knew we were there. We got there in the afternoon, and we knew that we wouldn't be able to do the climb that day. It was too late, but we figured we could scout out the top, you know, the top breaks to see how that would go. And and then the next day, you know, we would camp at our car, and then the next day we would do the climb. So we're poking around there at the top on the top of the platform, trying to find the break through, you know, the kaibab, and we hear above the roar of the wind, you can hear a distant sound. It sounds like the, you know, thwacking blades of a helicopter, right?
Hmm.
And we're sitting there kind of like, wow, that's kind of something, you know. And then the roar of the wind would pick up again, right? And because keep in mind, we're on the platform there, right on the rim,
right.
And you know, this, we're basically facing south, looking across the Cape Solitude, and overlooking the little Colorado below us. And the winds were just coming up out of the canyon, right,
mm-hmm.
And then whipping over the edge of the platform and really buffeting us in these gusts. So we're sitting there and we're listening as we poke around, and we could hear this thwacking getting louder, and it would, you know, and then it would disappear in the gusts and whatnot. But we couldn't pinpoint where it was from. Now, you know, at that time there had been limitations put on where people could fly in the canyon. You know, you had to stay above the rims, right?
Right.
So we weren't expecting anything below the rim, and we're looking to the south, and you couldn't see anything approaching us, right? But it's obviously getting louder and louder. And eventually, we look down, and there's a helicopter down below, way below the rim, and he's flying along just basically on course to us. I guess he'd come around Cape Solitude, and he was flying more or less right over this Confluence Butte
wow.
area. And then he started coming up, and presumably with the winds bringing him up too, and he got to the rim, and we're like looking right at this happening. This helicopter comes up and comes up to the rim, starts to flatten out at the rim. It flattened out its course of direction,
right.
And then started to tumble in the in the wind. And it was a little tiny helicopter, a little two-seater called a Robinson. And I mean, we're just we're blown away by seeing this happen, because this helicopter is tumbling across the sage, right?
Wow.
Like a quarter of a kilometer away from us, and in the middle of nowhere, you know, I might add. And so, you know, it didn't blow up or anything like that, like you see in the movies, but it was obviously, you know, a serious thing, and we didn't know what to expect. I mean, I figured that whoever was in there was a goner. So we hustled over to where the helicopter was lying, and by the time we got there, both the fellows in it had popped out.
Wow.
And you know, I've just remembered our the point about recollections. So this
oh,
story is a good example of recollections. So we get to the helicopter, and the pilot and his passenger, which is actually his father, again, a recollection of mine. But they're getting out, and they're basically unharmed, you know. And this
wow.
chopper was pretty beat up, and but the two guys were okay. And it turns out that this fellow had bought, I think it was the father, had bought the helicopter like 2 days before, and he had his son fly it up. You know, they were taking a trip, and when they got to the Grand Canyon, they decided to drop down and fly through the canyon for some ways. We don't know how far they flew below the rim, but it could have been that they dropped down at Cape Solitude, for all I know, you know, because I didn't actually see them until just before they came up to us in the Confluence Butte area. And you know, these guys were really shaken up, and we just couldn't believe that what we'd witnessed, and obviously that, you know, impacted our plans, because we had to get them out of there, and they didn't have a vehicle, of course, and so the four of us, you know, would have crammed into Bruce's Subaru at the time, and then we drove back out to the highway, and I can't recall if we drove them into Flagstaff or what, but I know that the next day the FAA brought out a well, we went back with them and some officials from the FAA to the crash site, and so, you know, fortunately we had taken Bruce had taken really nice detailed notes of the road out there. You know, this is before GPS, so he would just say drive. We drove 8.2 miles, you know, on this road, and then turn left at a 120-degree angle to head this way. And so we were able to get back out there very quickly with these guys. And the federal inspectors were, you know, checking out the crash. And then they eventually brought out a flatbed to haul it out, to haul the chopper out. But the fellow I remember from the government, and this is the recollections part of the story, he asked Bruce and I to each write a detailed account of how we recalled, you know, the situation unfolding. And so we did that. We didn't actually do that day, but we did it within a couple of days.
Okay.
You know, I presumably would have, this is before email, but I presumably would have mailed it in to somebody or maybe phoned it in. I don't know, but Bruce and I did compare our recollections of what we had seen. Now, keep in mind, you know, we were standing right next to each other, watching this whole event unfold in real time, and we had significantly different recollections of how that helicopter tumbled across the landscape. And I felt so, you know, confident that I had recalled this correctly. And for Bruce, who's a very accomplished pilot and backcountry pilot, you know, you know, he for him to have a somewhat different take on this when it was so firmly etched in my mind, that to me was a really a good example of how recollections of events can differ from individual to individual, you know. And so I think ever since that time, I've always thought that yeah, you know, you're listening to sworn testimony in a courtroom, and somebody's giving their recollection. But how accurate is that recollection really compared with what really happened? You know,
right.
And I'm not saying that I was wrong, and I'm not saying that Bruce was wrong. It's just that we had different perspectives on it, and we each filed our own report with the FAA representative. Acknowledging that we interpreted it differently, but that's how we saw it as individuals, you know. So it was a very interesting experience, and those guys were so fortunate that we were there, you know, because they didn't have a radio at that point, you know, and they would have had to walk out.
Yeah,
they had no idea where to go, and and I don't think that. Well, my recollection, my understanding was that. You know, there was not anybody necessarily aware of what their flight plan was.
Right.
Presumably that nobody was aware that they were going to be flying below the rim, right? So I'm sure that the pilot caught some flack from the government representative for that, because we couldn't leave it out of our, you know, out of our accident descriptions. We both, Bruce and I both described, you know, very accurately or significantly that they were below the rim substantially and then coming up, and right. that's when the accident happened. So, yeah, it was a very, very kind of exciting thing. And then, but fortunately, after all that, you know, we dealt with all that, and then we actually went down and did the climb. It was pretty anticlimactic at that point.
Okay.
But we were able to actually deal with that. After, I think what happened was that we went out with the FAA representative, and they eventually brought a flatbed truck out
right.
to bring the helicopter remains back on. But then we had our discussion with the fellow, and then that afternoon, or probably the next morning, we went down and actually climbed the butte. Mm. So it was it was a fun little climb, not too difficult,
mm-hmm.
the way I like them. And again, it was just great being out there and sharing these experiences, you know, with my good friend Bruce. So
nice.
It would have been nice, I think, to you know, have it all unfold in a slightly less chaotic sense, you know, without that wreck happening,
right.
Because we had planned to also spend some time hiking and try to get down to the Colorado River. There's a nice red wall route, I think. I've never been up it, but mm-hmm. you probably have. That comes up from the Little Colorado, about 2 miles upstream.
Yeah,
you have?
No.
Oh, no? No. Well, you know, you can get right to the rim there once you get up.
No, I've heard of it. I just haven't done it.
Mm-hmm. So, we'd wanted to do that and spend a little more time in the area. But at least, you know, at least we got the summit. And at least we were there to help those guys out,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, they weren't hurt seriously. So they would have survived and you know, made their way to help, but it would have been really uncomfortable for them. So, and you know, you get to be the Good Samaritan for a change, right? So, that was the excitement about Confluence Butte, hmm. right? Not much of a, you know, not a, I mean, it's a nice climb. It's in the Coconino, and nice south facing, sloping slabs of Coconino. So, you know, as in so many of those Coconino summits or routes, you know, you're working up the cross stratification, and you know, the ledges kind of connect with the geology, right?
Right.
And it's really a cool rock to climb on. So that was kind of like a turning point there. Because at that point, in 1986, I started to get fairly focused on my work as a student, and I got more focused, and I found I could spend less time away from California.
Okay.
And so I did one or two hikes, like in Marble Canyon, that there was – I remember I traveled to a geological conference in Las Vegas. And, you know, the University of California paid my way to give a presentation.
Hmm.
And then afterwards I went and did some hikes in Marble Canyon, right? So,
okay.
that was just minor stuff to keep me in the game, I guess. And so.
When did you finish your PhD?
Yeah, I finished it in 84.
Okay.
In, November of 84. And, by that time, well, I had connected with the people in the Geological Survey of Canada. There was a fellow who worked at the GSC named George Jeletsky, who was a Russian, came over after World War II, and he was phenomenal, paleontologist and stratigrapher. And he had worked in the GSC since late 40s,
okay.
and doing geological mapping and stratigraphic studies and paleontological studies. He was a giant in the field, really, and so they needed a replacement for him at the time, he'd heard about me through the contacts with my professor at Davis, Peter Ward, and Peter had told him, well, this guy Jim is a he loves to get out in the bush and hike around, and you know, and he's doing the exact kind of geology that you're interested in. So you guys might think about it and think about hiring him. And so they hired me on a postdoc, which is a 2-year position.
Okay.
And I started that immediately after I graduated. I mean, I could have waited a little bit longer, but they wanted me to start as soon as possible. And I really, you know, Tom, at the time, I didn't think anything that I was going to stay there in Canada, you know.
Interesting.
I just figured, well, what a great opportunity, you know, to go up there and live in a foreign country and do science and maybe get to do some field work in remote areas. And then I can look for a job, you know, in the U.S. And so I took it, right, and I went to Ottawa. And what a difference from California and Arizona, man. I tell you, I drove my stuff across country. I had a Toyota pickup by that time, and I got a U-Haul trailer, and I put some stuff in, basic stuff, right? And I drove across country that, and then I remember I got to Detroit, and Sarnia is the crossing point there. In the Detroit area, and I in the late afternoon, it was kind of a the end of November. It's kind of bleak in Canada at that time, and it got dark. And of course, I had this idea in my mind that Canada was like a frozen wasteland, and it was kind of a stereotypic image, you know, of ice and snow and Eskimos and stuff like that. I mean, you're not even supposed to say that term anymore. But that was, you know, the idea I had in my mind, because that was the image I grew up with so much of in stereotypic media presentations that we saw about Canada. Even though, you know, my family and I had visited in the Canadian Rockies when I was younger. So I started driving across southern Ontario and expecting to see big piles of snow everywhere, and it was nothing, right? There was nothing there. It was just blisteringly cold. And so I got to Ottawa, and I had some connections there that I'd made ahead of time, and I had a place to stay. And so I settled in there, and I spent a couple of years there, and that was then supposed to be the end of my term, right, my postdoc.
Right.
I didn't get any. I was looking for positions in the U.S. I applied for a couple of teaching positions, but I didn't get them. But I got to do some field work with the GSC, and one of the things I did was to go to Haida Gwaii, which at that time was called Queen Charlotte Islands, and it's off the west coast of Canada, British Columbia, about halfway from the U.S. border to Juneau, I guess. It's pretty close, actually, to the southern Alaska Panhandle region. And so I got to do field work up there with a helicopter and on Zodiacs, you know, out on the ocean. And I was thinking, man, what a life this is, you know. And then, of course, after my 2 years, the postdoc was up. That was it. The term was over. But they said, look, we would like to have you on as a permanent position, permanent staff member. But because you're American, it's not so simple to just hire you right on. And we have to do all this paperwork. But we'll put you on a contract basis, the same terms of working that, you know, you had as your postdoc. Pay would be the same and everything. And you just be a term contractor for us, and you can continue to do everything that you've been doing. And I was, at this time, I was thinking, well, I don't have any other options yet in the U.S.,
right.
And this is a lot of fun, so I'll just take this as long as I can. And I, at that time, right around that time was when my postdoc ended, I got a job offer to join U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park.
Oh, wow.
This actually, all the time I was in graduate school in Davis, California, I was looking at this Menlo position as like the best thing I could ever get, you know. Mm. And I remember thinking to myself, well, Davy Jones, that was the name of the paleontologist who was in that job at the time. If he ever retires, you know, maybe I can get that job. Well, he did retire. He went to Berkeley to teach, and so that position opened up, and I applied for it, and I thought, wow, this is great. And I actually got a request to come down and interview in the Bay Area, which I did, and I gave a talk or two, and they gave me some time and money to drive around, and, you know, and I'd been in the Bay Area many times when I was a graduate student, but this time it was a little different because, number one, I was looking at a career ahead of me living in the Bay Area, and number two, I'd spent 2 summers up in the Canadian wilderness, you know, and I had a totally different opportunity up north as far as a long-term career goes, and those opportunities were not going to be available to me in Menlo Park. It was strictly going to be an office-based job, you know, with very limited field work opportunities. So I don't know if I'm going too far afield here, Tom.
No, this is good.
You just got to let me know because I will get back to the Grand Canyon eventually, but this was kind of a significant interlude, right?
Yes, I'm taking it just for that. That's good.
Okay. Anyways, so I remember driving around the Bay Area and doing a couple of hikes, you know, and Point Reyes and visiting kind of the places I'd visited when I was a graduate student. Hmm. But it just didn't, you know, the Bay Area just didn't have the cachet anymore because I was going to become another one of those ants in sitting in their cars, commuting back and forth across these bridges or, you know, wherever, going to my job in some high-priced neighborhood that I wouldn't be able to afford the housing for. And it just, like, it had a real big impact on me. And I thought to myself, yeah, it's my dream job, but maybe my concept of dream job has changed here, you know? And it may be, in fact, it seems pretty certain that the opportunities in Canada really override what is available here. So, you know, so I went back to Ottawa, and I actually had to write a letter. I called my colleague Norm Soule, who was the head of the stratigraphy branch in the D.C. area. I guess it's Reston, Virginia.
Okay.
And he had actually invited me to apply for the job, and I had to decline it, you know, to him. And after they were so courteous to bring me out, interview me, and make me the offer, and I just said, you know, Norm, I just have so many more opportunities in Canada. And, you know, he said, he was very gracious, and he said, you know, I don't blame you one bit, you know. Mm-hmm. What the opportunities you have working with the USGS in that position were nothing compared with what I would have in Canada. And he said, I don't, you know, no grudges or anything like that. Yeah. You got to do what's best for you. So I declined the job, which was a big deal for me because, you know, that had been such a driving force and ambition when I was in graduate school. But I basically totally changed perspective once I'd spent some time in the bush of Canada. So,
and this is, I mean,
so yeah,
I've never been there, but I think about the Inland Passage, that country where there are these giant trees coming right down to the sea water edge. And it's sort of, I think of granite. I don't think about a lot of, you know, limestone and sort of fossiliferous rocks, where you might get some paleo work done. So I clearly have that wrong.
Well, no, you're right on both counts. You know, and that's one of the beauties of it is there's so much diversity, right?
Mm.
And so in the coastal areas, in the Inland Passage that you're talking about, which is, I mean, it's an archipelago of islands, you know,
right,
varying sizes that line the coast. And on the mainland side of that passage is all the granite that forms the coast mountains. And, you know, the coast mountains basically start in right down here in the Vancouver area.
Okay.
And they extend all the way up into Alaska, right? And it's the second largest orogenic belt in the world, you know, after the Himalaya. And there's some really giant peaks in there, right? huge peaks, and up in the Wrangell St. Elias area that straddles Alaska and BC Yukon,
right.
And big mountains, and a huge ice fields, you know, and so it's a very unique area because you have all that granite, which is resultant from intrusion on the leading edge of the continent, you know, where you have subduction of the oceanic Pacific plate
right.
going under North America, and that geological relationship results in all this volcanic activity, and the granite is the rock that forms to like as the basement of the volcanoes.
Right.
But then adjacent to those volcanoes, you had sedimentary basins accumulating along, you know, the western margin of the continent. Mm. And that's where, you know, the animals live. That's where the sediments were eroded off the continent, brought to the west coast and by rivers, and then deposited in these basins. I mean, the same thing's happening now, right, off the west coast,
right.
From Baja all the way up to southern Alaska, and some of the basins are bigger than others. Some of them are very small. Some places the continental shelf is very narrow. Other places it's wider, so you get a bigger basin, more sediment accumulation. And the same thing, you know, kind of characterized the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods of time on the West Coast. So you had these sedimentary basins accumulating there, and they have been preserved these today in exposures on Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte Islands, and Vancouver Island, and also in the islands of Southeast Alaska. There's a lot of exposed sedimentary rocks. So
Geological Survey of Canada, were they looking to hire you to help map that country?
Yeah, to a certain extent there was, yeah, and they were. And the thing is that with my, you know, kind of, I'm not trying to toot my horn here or anything like that, but I kind of have a unique background because I study these fossils, but I use them to address geological problems, right?
Right.
Trying to interpret mapping relationships and whatnot in the various rock units, and plus I love to get out there and just go everywhere, right? I'm not interested in just driving to the end of the road and collecting the data that's there. You know, I want to go down and walk up that river valley and find out what's up at the top, right? And so, you know, that's the kind of character or person that they were looking for to do geological mapping. And that's kind of what my predecessor did, Gillespie. He was very much a field-oriented person.
Okay.
But, you know, and I think that's why he and I hit it off so well, is because, you know, I just have to get as far out as I can get to get the most data, right? Because once you have the maximum amount of data, then you can make the most comprehensive interpretation, right, of the geology.
That's
so,
right.
So yeah, the Geological Survey was hiring. They wanted me to remap certain parts and provide a more detailed map of certain parts of Canada. And so my first project was actually on Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte Islands. And I spent, my 6 or 7 years there in total. And, you know, I had a limited helicopter budget, but I did have some helicopter time. But I had unlimited time on a Zodiac, you know, and
okay.
I spent several four-month field seasons on Haida Gwaii, you know, looking at the geology, and I also would be hosting other geologists, right? It's not like I was out there by myself. I had students that I was supporting, master's students, a couple PhD students looking at aspects of the geology.
Cool.
So I was kind of like the project coordinator, right?
Okay.
I had to make sure all these other people doing their scientific tasks were provided with the resources they needed to
right.
undertake that geology. And then, you know, at the end of it all, when they'd all gone home, then I would have a month or so of my own to focus on my own interests, right? And it worked out really well. I loved it, right? It was just a great opportunity being outdoors all the time. But I had some challenges with relationships, and it got it got a little awkward, and I mean, that's partly this whole business with this 10-year period here where I didn't do anything in the canyon, you know, because I met people in Ottawa and got involved with them, and I had a daughter, and the mother and I didn't get along, unfortunately. You know, I don't want to spend too much on this, but basically, a combination of the challenges of trying to be a research scientist, a young one, right, be successful,
right,
is really demanding, right? And then you're also trying to balance family life with that, and which is, you know, another challenge, right? And so, you know, after a number of years, so I contracted for another 2.5 years in Ottawa after my postdoc before they could finally get me hired on.
Okay.
They did all the paperwork, right, to hire an American citizen into this job. And at that point, then I was working with my colleague, George Gillespie, and he was getting pretty on, and they said the GSC, the plan was that I would be transferred to Calgary once Gillespie had basically passed away, right?
Okay.
Because they were giving me the opportunity to work with him, to learn as much as I could from him about geology and paleontology. And he was one of these guys that, well, he died in the hospital from a stroke while he was correcting the proofs of his last paper, right?
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, up until the end, he was focused on that, and that's how driven he was. And I mean, I'm not saying that's good or bad. I know that he had some complicated issues with his family, and mm-hmm. you know, some of his children didn't come to his funeral, mm-hmm. and things like that. So it was, but that's the type of person he was, and they were, the GSC was giving me the opportunity to absorb as much from him as I could, right? And
mm-hmm.
but eventually he did pass away, and that would have been in the January of 89. So at that point they said, you know, the plan was that I would move to Calgary where the other paleontologists were in the GSC. But in the summer of 88, I had flown out to Vancouver and then gone up to Queen Charlotte Islands for my second trip, and I actually met a project geologist there, and from our Vancouver office, and so he was giving me money and resources, much as I did subsequently to other people, and we really hit it off because he was doing geological mapping, and he would collect these fossils, and he had no idea whether he was looking at Jurassic rocks or Cretaceous rocks or what, or Triassic. But he would show me the fossils, and I would say, well, you're in the Middle Jurassic there, you know. That locality is Middle Jurassic because those are Middle Jurassic ammonites. And so he loved it that I was just feeding into him immediately, you know. So then he could basically complete his geological maps in the field. And
oh, wow.
And we talked a lot about this. And after you know, a couple of weeks, he said, look, why don't you come to Vancouver instead of Calgary? We could maybe get you transferred to Vancouver instead. And you could be, you know, working out of our office directly. And then he said, and you know, if you want to do this, you can take over my project on Queen Charlotte Islands, and you could be the project leader and finish all the mapping off, which was pretty generous of him to offer that. So I thought about that, and I said, well, of course, you know, I mean, Vancouver's like California, you know, Cascadia, you know, it's the same, the same kind of, ecological, you know, geological, cultural region, right?
Mm.
Not like Calgary, which is kind of cow town, but so I said, okay, let's do that, you know, and they quickly cobbled together a plan to transfer me from the Calgary division to the Pacific division based in Vancouver, and then I got a mover to bring me and my stuff out to Vancouver in May. And then I immediately went out in the field, put the stuff in storage, and I went in the field. And by this time, I had, you know, a daughter in Ottawa, Right. And it was kind of a shaky situation with her mother. But I said, look, come out to Vancouver at the end of the summer of 89, and we'll see what we can do. We'll get an apartment and, you know, and get this thing going. And so she did do that. Mother and daughter came out in September after I returned from the field in the summer of 89, and we got an apartment. I got the apartment before they came out so that it would be organized and whatnot.
Hmm.
And then basically started my life as a research scientist in the Vancouver office of the GSC. But the mother and I fought a lot, and it was not easy. And so after a couple of years, I think it was 93, so I stuck it out for 3.5 years. In the spring of 93, I said, you know, we're just going to have to part here. It's not serving anybody's interests. And so we did, but unfortunately it was not an amicable parting.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I didn't see my daughter for like 17 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I mean, I didn't even hear from her, right? I mean, initially there was contact. You know, I would see her every other weekend, right, for 3 days or something like that. And you know, even that was a struggle, though, because the mother was always creating reasons why it couldn't happen this week and or whatever. So I worked as much as I could with the courts in British Columbia to try and maximize my time with my daughter. And even the court system wouldn't support me, you know, when I needed it. And there were times when the mother was clearly acting in contempt of the court by denying access and whatnot, and the judge would just admonish her but never give her any punishment, right? So she would just go on and continue to do it. Eventually, I tried to take Chelsea, my daughter, to Arizona and to be with her extended family, right? My family,
uh-huh.
And for a summer vacation. And I went to pick her up. I had the tickets in hand. You know, we were going to go on the airplane that day, and I went to pick her up. And she's screaming at her mother's house. And I don't need to go into these details, but the upshot was that we canceled the trip. And then because of the scary aspect of it, so my daughter was like 7 or 8 at this point.
Mm.
So because of the scary aspect, no, not even that old. 5 or 6. Anyways, I got involved with a counselor, and the social system basically said, we don't think it's a good idea that you spend time with your daughter anymore, you know.
Wow.
Which was unbelievable, because I'd been doing everything I could, you know, to be positive and supportive. And of course the mother is going to have a totally different position on this, but I was kind of blown away, because, you know, I had done everything I could legally to show my support, you know, emotionally to show my support for this child. And they said, because she gets so traumatized by your presence, you know, it's probably best you don't spend any time with her anymore. But you know, the reason she's traumatized because it's her mother, you know, who's poisoning her. Well, we don't care, you know. So that started this 17-year hiatus, you know, before I finally reconnected with my daughter.
And so just to not leave us hanging here, mm-hmm. were you able to reconnect with her in a substantive relationship kind of way?
Oh yeah, yeah. It worked. It worked out really well eventually. So I, you know, I spent 15 years here and continued my life, right, and met other people, and you know, met my wife, we've had a great time, and no more kids, but
right.
That was a mutual decision. But eventually, yes, my mother was coming up to Vancouver for a visit, and by that time she was about 83 or 84, and you know, I you just don't know when your parents are that age how many more times you're going to get to see them, right?
Right.
So I basically went online. And I searched online for my daughter's name, right? Chelsea Kale, Kelso was her name. And it was supposed to be hyphenated, Kelso Haggard, but she dropped that. And so I was just searching on on these names, and I came up with a couple of hits, right? And I just, and there was an email address, and so I wrote an email message, and I said, hi, you know, my name is Jim Haggart. If you are Chelsea Kale that I'm looking for, you know, I'm your father, and, you know, you were born in Ontario on this date, you're this age, and
this is really neat because, you know, you reached out to her saying, my mom's going to be here, and that's your grandmother. And
that's
you
exactly
might,
what I said, yeah.
You might want to meet
and,
her.
And so I said, you know, we haven't had a relationship, but your grandmother is going to be here, and she's this age, and, you know, you might not have any more opportunities, and if you want to get together with her, then we can set that up. And that's it. I just fired that email off. It was very short. Mm-hmm. It was less than shorter than I spoke in it. But I fired that off, and a couple of days later, I get an answer. It was like, what? You know, it was totally unexpected. Totally unexpected. Because I figured even if I got the right person, it there wouldn't be any response, right?
Right.
But she did respond, and very very favorably. And she said she wanted to meet, you know, my mother. So I set up an appointment of a meeting, and we just met in a local restaurant. My mom came up and stayed in town with us for a few days, and then I met with Chelsea and my mom in a local restaurant for a couple of hours. You know, and it worked out perfect. So we've had a lot of connection since then, right? And and my mother got to see her a few more times before my mother passed away, and so it was a great. It's been a great experience to reconnect.
Yeah.
With her, so.
Yeah.
In fact, her birthday was just, my birthday was last Friday, and her birthday was last Tuesday, I think.
Oh, cool.
16th
Happy birthday.
And 19th. Yeah, okay. Thanks. But we exchanged, exchanged greetings and things families do on birthdays. And so, it's a great opportunity, a great experience that's happened to me in a positive way, right, since that original relationship.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah.
But I can appreciate, you know, why you were away from the canyon for 10 years. You know, given all that was happening with the job and the relations and everything else.
Yeah, it really was a challenge, you know. And I mean, and so it's kind of interesting because when I finally got back to the canyon, I was actually in Arizona with my partner, Chelsea's mother, at the time. And we had driven down there from Vancouver for several days, you know, three-day drive. Mm. And we're visiting with my mother. And as every other thing we did together, it was not going well, you know. And we were having fights. And my mother had a ground floor apartment, and she was able to rent the apartment above for visitors to stay, right? And so Chelsea and her mother and I were in the apartment above, and there were a couple of fights, and including like the police came at one point because the mother was screaming so much, during this trip, I convinced them that I was going to take, or that I convinced Cheryl, Chelsea's mother, to let me take a trip up to the Grand Canyon and just to do day hikes. That's all I was going to do, right? And I just kind of wanted to see what the place was like, right? See if it was still there after so many years. And so this was in 94,
okay.
In April. And
you hadn't been to the canyon since sort of climbing Confluence Butte?
Well, that was in 86, yeah. And then I did a couple of day hike in Marble Canyon in 1988.
Okay.
And that was it. So this was in April of 94.
So it'd be 6 years.
When I went up, to the the South Rim and I don't remember the vehicle, but I just did some day hikes, you know, and to try and reconnect, right? And I wasn't expecting, I mean, you know, it's not like I was expecting some big revitalization, you know, an emotional recharge or reconnection or something like that. I didn't expect anything. You know, I just wanted to go for a hike, right, and see what, you know, what the Grand Canyon was looking like. And so I did some short hikes, day hikes, you know. You know the Shoshone Point route?
Yeah.
So I did that, you know, as a day hike from the Kaibab Trail and came up the Shoshone Point route. That was fun. And then I went and climbed Coronado Butte.
Okay.
And I climbed Sinking Ship. And then I did a really nice day hike down the Grand Butte Trail into Cottonwood Creek and did a climb out Cottonwood Creek through the Red Wall. You know, it was a nice, just four really nice days of hiking, right, that were very satisfying and accomplishing, and two summits, by the way. And then went back there, you know, went back down to Phoenix, and then we eventually came back to Vancouver. And when I was coming down from the last day hike there, back to Phoenix, you know, I was thinking, I've been thinking about people that I've been hiking with in the canyon, and you know, my big interest, or one of my big partners, had been Bruce Grubbs, right? Because we did so many climbs together and longer trips too, and
yes,
and the ski trips, and you know, and I knew he lived in Flagstaff, but I didn't know where he was because he had moved by that time, and his shop, the Alpineer, had closed. So he wasn't, you know, involved in that. But I knew he, because I found a Day Hikes of Arizona book, and, you know, it's written by Bruce Grubbs, right?
Okay.
And so I could see on the back cover, it said Bruce flies charters and tour flights out of Sedona, Arizona. So I thought, well, maybe I can connect with him there. So when I was driving back to Phoenix, I stopped off and bypassed, went over to Sedona, to the airport, and I walked in, and I said, you know, just, it was very casual then, I just started knocking on some doors, and I got some pilots, or people, anyways, and I said, does anybody know Bruce Grubbs? And they said, well, yeah, we know Bruce, yeah, he's a pilot for, I forget the name of the flying company,
right.
And, but he's not here right now. And I said, oh, well, that's too bad, you know, I'm an old friend of his, and I was hoping we could reconnect. I said, do you mind if I leave my business card with
cool.
you? And so I did. I left him my business card. You know, I said, hi, Bruce. You know, it's Jim. You know, we should connect and get back together. And so, you know, eventually he did. He got the card, and he called me up, and we started chatting, and it was just right back to normal, right?
Cool.
Back to good times. And so it did take us a while before we decided, you know, to plan a trip. And at that time, I was going through, you know, the big start of the big divorce and whatnot. So I couldn't just drop everything and come back down to Arizona right away. So it did take a year. And then in 95, in April of 95, we planned to do this hike out on the Esplanade out towards out by Great Thumb.
Okay.
And Bruce said, you know, do you remember Art Christensen? You know, and of course I'd hiked with Art several times in the canyon, and I climbed raw with him, and of course I remember Art. And he said, well, maybe would you mind if Art came along on this trip? And I said, no, that sounds great. You know, so we planned it that the three of us would get together in April '95, and do this hike down into Matkatamiba Canyon.
Hey Jim,
yeah,
I'm gonna jump right in here and say this would be a great time to put a comma on this oral history.
Okay.
Because I would like to know about the April 1995 Matkat trip with Art, because this is going to be the start, I think, of a long relationship you're going to have with Art, if I get this right.
Yeah.
Climbing in the canyon, hiking in the canyon.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So maybe this is a good time to just put a comma here.
Well, it sounds great because you're absolutely correct. You know, this is kind of like a renaissance for me, and especially with you know, the hiking relationship that I established with Art, and which has kind of persisted for, you know, the entire 25 years since. But Bruce was a big part of that too for many, many hikes. So we can touch on all those in the future. But
nice.
It is a good breaking point.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, because this is you could get a sense this is some pretty difficult material you've just covered here, which is important. And I'm glad you did that. Thank you. So with that, let's conclude part 8. Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, March 21, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom, for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.